we'll welcome everybody here today for the teleconference on the War of the Dots and other fascinating events in the history of Braille. We will be recording the teleconference so that we can share this with people afterwards. And we'll trim off the beginning and the end, so that discussion won't be a part of that. If you need to mute yourself while the presentation is going on, pressing *6 should mute or unmute your line. It switches it on or off. So pressing *6 should mute to avoid introducing extra background noise and such to the call. These teleconferences are typically held every 2 months or so and are free of charge for members of BLC or members of organizations that are corporate members of BLC. We will, after the presentation is done, we will open it up to questions and give everybody up to about 2 minutes to ask a question or make a comment in response to either of the speakers. Today we have two people presenting. First will be Natalie Marciniello, who is currently president of Braille Literacy Canada. And Jen Golden, who is our past president, will also take a part of the presentation. And when they are done, then we'll open it up to questions and comments and discussion from there. Before we begin, are there any other questions or housekeeping items that anybody needs? I hear there are some more people joining, so I'll just repeat that to mute your line if you need to while this is going on, you can press *6 and *6 again to unmute. And we will be recording this too to share with people afterwards. So just before we begin, are there any questions or other housekeeping matters to attend to? Not hearing anything. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, when it comes time for questions, will you do sort of what we've typically done, where people will just say their names first, so then we'll have a list so it doesn't get too chaotic?
Yes, I figured I'd. We'll explain that again when we get there. But
sounds good.
If there's nothing else, then I will turn it over to Natalie, who can get us started on this fascinating history.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us for story time today. And since we have a lot to share with you, I think I'll just get right into it. So obviously everyone here is aware that Braille is what ultimately allowed blind people to be literate. But I would probably say, and I think we would all agree, that fewer people know exactly what led to its invention and its ultimate acceptance, which involved, as you will hear from us today, involved many twists and turns in its history. But, you know, for centuries, we had kind of different versions of the print alphabet for sighted people. And for the most part, most people believed for a very, very long time that blind people would be unable to participate in kind of normal society. And so this is probably, I would argue, why it wasn't until relatively recently that a tactile reading system like Braille was invented in comparison to print that's been around for so long. And so in a lot of different ways, the history of Braille is very much tied up with the history of blind people, in that it's connected to the changing perception of blind people over time as well. I'll just remind everyone that if you can mute your phone, just so that we don't hear background noise, that's *6, and then when it's time for questions, we'll ask you to unmute by pressing *6 again. Okay. So I want to take it back to the 1700s. And at that time, there was a man named Denis Diderot, and he lived somewhere between 1712 to 1784. And he was an intellectual who wrote about many New Age ideas. This was the Enlightenment, when many people were kind of challenging traditional ideas. And he was probably the first person to write about what he called the plight of blind people, so essentially the problems experienced by the blind in society. And he wrote about a man, a blind man named Nicholas Saunderson, who was a blind mathematician at Cambridge. And this got the attention of a man named Valentin Auy, which some of you may find that name familiar. Auy lived in Paris at the time, and he worked as kind of a foreign translator and in the world of business. So he really had no background in education at all, but he was really, really fascinated by what he read from Diderot's writings. And he lived in Paris at the time, and he read all of these works published by Diderot, and this is what eventually inspired him to create what became the first school for the blind in the world, Institut des Jeunes Aveugles. And there were other influences, other factors that influenced Auy that I think are worth mentioning. So he wrote about how he saw a group of blind men being mocked for entertainment in the public square in Paris. And this really, really bothered him, just the reality for blind people at the time. And he really wanted to improve the situation. He also wrote about a blind woman that he got to know from Austria who accompanied her own music and who was able to play cards independently, which at the time was quite remarkable. And what she did is that she would make little holes at the top of the cards so that she could identify them. So all of this led to Auy wanting to develop his own school. And his first pupil was actually a blind beggar named Lessard, who Auy met when walking around one day. He saw Lessard begging for money. And he dropped a coin, and Lessard actually tried to give that coin back because he thought it was dropped by mistake because of its high quantity. He thought it was probably a mistake. And Auy was so impressed by Lissel's keen sense of touch that he wanted to educate him and try developing some kind of reading system with him. The problem was that Lissel had to support his family. And so what's really interesting is that Auy ended up paying Lissel to be his first student. So that would be nice if that continued today, huh? So Lissard was the first student, and the first method used was actually quite crude and very slow in terms of its process. So what Auy did was he created a slotted board into which tiles with embossed Roman letters could be placed. And so this was very slow and expensive and not very practical, but it was still remarkable in that it was the first time that the blind could have any sense of literacy or reading. But it wasn't very practical ultimately. And what happened one day is that Lissard was at Valentin Auy's house and found a funeral cart that had fallen onto the floor, and he picked it up and he realized that he was able to feel the print on the card because it was pressed so strongly into the paper. And this is what led Auy and Lissard to realize that maybe what they should be working on is embossed writing onto paper. And so I always find this story kind of fascinating, just kind of like the rest of the story itself, that it was probably such a mundane thing that happened, but the very fact that this card fell onto the floor and that they had this inspiration and that he realized he could feel the print is what kind of led to everything else. It ultimately brings us to where we are today. So it's really interesting that history works like that sometimes. But this, too, was a very slow process. So the way it worked to create embossed Roman letters, they started with thick, dampened paper that was placed on top. And this was followed by a layer of softer material, basically. And that was placed, the whole thing together was placed into a strong press. And then when it was dry, the pages were stuck back to back, sewn together, and then they were put together between thick board covers, essentially. And so this was slow and expensive, but this was the first form of reading for the blind. Now, at the time, this is the late 1700s, education wasn't available to everyone, let alone the blind. And so Valentin Ahui had his first students give many public demonstrations of this method. And there was some criticism, people who thought that it was ridiculous to educate the blind, that there was no need for it. They actually got the attention of King Louis the, I think at that time it was Louis the 16th, and his court, and they were really impressed by the idea that the blind could read. And so for quite some time it became very fashionable to support the school. Now, fortunately, this was the time of the French Revolution, and so what ended up happening is that the standards of the school began to drop. We didn't have the materials he needed, and also there were personal threats to his life. And so Napoleon actually closed down the school in 1801. And what happened after that, despite the fact that the school was closed, Ahui was invited to demonstrate his method to the King of Russia, who was really interested. And along the way, on his way to Russia, he was also invited to present to other courts in other countries. And so in a lot of ways, Valentin Ahui is responsible not just for the establishment of schools abroad for the blind, but also for the development of tactile reading systems elsewhere. So he played a really big role. Despite the fact that the King of Russia was interested and extended this invitation, once Ahui got to Russia, he didn't actually have the support he needed, and he stayed for 11 years with very little materials and support. And it's written that he went back to Paris feeling very disillusioned. So what's interesting to think about is that Ahui, like many other professionals at that time, other people working on tactile systems, felt that the blind should be as much like the sighted as possible. And so because of this, it was ideal to use a tactile system that was very much like print. Now, to us today, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But you kind of have to think back to where everything began. And their intentions were actually quite well-meaning. And there were some blind, even superintendents of schools for the blind at that time, who felt this way, that, why should we be different from the norm? And so the logic, if you kind of try to see it through the lens of that time, made sense. But, of course, at that time they knew very little about tactile perception and the fact that raised Roman letters are actually very slow and difficult to decipher. So now if we talk about the beginnings of Braille, in 1809, which is actually when Louis Braille was also born, Charles Barbier published a piece of work about writing a tactile system that involved using a penknife. And this is what led to his eventual development of what he called night writing. And Charles Barbier developed night writing basically to allow military men to exchange messages in the dark. And this is a part of the story that I think most people know more about. Because what happened is that the military wasn't interested in this code at all, but they encouraged him to present his work at the School for the Blind, which, by the way, that was the same school that Ahui had created and established. It was reopened by under the direction of someone else. So he presented his system, and the students were really interested, but they felt that several changes had to be made. So night writing is basically, if you imagine a table with seven columns across and seven going down, each square in that table represented a different phonetic sound for the French language. And so to write night writing, you would use a 7x2 matrix, and you would just write corresponding to which phonetic symbol you wanted. So if it was, third one down and two across, you would do three dots on the left and two on the right. And so the students felt that, number one, they needed to replace the phonetics with the actual alphabet so that spelling would be possible. They needed a way to represent punctuation and numbers. And then the other problem was that this matrix was very difficult to feel because it extended, it stretched beyond the reading finger. And so Louis Braille was one of the students at the school. And at the age of 12, he started thinking more about this. And he made two changes immediately. He changed the matrix so that it was smaller and fit under the finger. So it became a 3x2 matrix, as we all know, of course. And he replaced phonetics for the alphabet. Now, what's really interesting about this story is that a lot of people assume that the first 10 letters of the Braille alphabet are arbitrary, right? We know that after the first 10 letters, you add a dot, and then after those 10 letters, you add another dot. But the first 10 letters, A to J, are not actually arbitrary. Louis Braille was very systematic in the development of his code. So basically, if you look at only the top 4 dots of the Braille cell, you can make up to 15 combinations. So what Louis Braille did is he got rid of anything that he felt would be confusing to feel, like single dots other than dot 1, and other kind of symbols that he felt would be confusing by touch. And this left him with the ten symbols that we now know as A to J. And he published his code in 1829, and at that time that included the music code as well, the Braille music code, which hasn't changed at all. And in that very first edition, punctuation was actually designated by a series of different dashes and dots. So that also changed in his second edition. It's kind of an interesting fact that a lot of people don't know about. The students they loved the idea of the Braille code, and they wrote it, they used it for personal communications, and they painstakingly wrote a book in Braille to show their support, which involved kind of chiseling out the dots that they didn't need in the cell just because of the methods they used. The headmaster at the time was not a supporter of Braille. He was actually very influenced by something called Alstom type from Scotland, which also involved raised Roman letters. And unfortunately, it wasn't until 1952, a few months after Louis Braille died prematurely, that he wrote about his change of heart. And it wasn't until 1954 that Braille was officially adopted in France. So I want to talk a little bit about the concept of the acceptance of Braille, because it was not straightforward even when it was officially adopted in France. At the time, in the 1800s, there were many different codes that were developed and used and attempted, and most of them were raised Roman letters. And this included codes that were supported by blind people as well. And in Britain, just to give you a sense of how many codes were used at the time, in Britain in the 1800s, there was at one time 6 codes being used, just in England alone. And it wasn't until, I think, about 1870 that the Association for the Blind in Britain voted in favor of a modified version of Braille, but these other codes were still in existence and being used. And Jen will talk a little bit about the American story in the 1900s, and although a modified version of Braille was also adopted there in the 1930s, there was a very sordid history and many disagreements. And I found a quote by someone named John Sibley, who was the superintendent of the Missouri School for the Blind, which, as a side note, they were the first to actually start using Braille very early on in the 1860s. And what Sibley said was that after many debates about which tactile system should be used, in the end, the solution was only found when blind people were held as the inventors and the judges. And so I just want to say a few words about some of these other codes to give you a sense of what was happening at the time. So there was a man named Gal, that was his last name, I don't remember his first name, but he's from Scotland, and in the 1800s he developed something that was called a triangular alphabet. So it was a combination of raised upper and lowercase Roman letters, and this was in 1826. And this was just one of many different codes that were developed at that time. And what happened is that Samuel Gridley Howe, who was the superintendent of what became the Perkins School for the Blind, he was a very well-established, well-respected professional in the field of blindness. And he was very influenced by Gal and his code. And this led to Samuel Gridley Howe developing what is now known as Boston type. And this is also based on raised Roman letters. And because Howe was so influential, this was used by many people in the U.S. in the 1800s. At the same time, this was a raised Roman code. At the same time, there were others who developed arbitrary codes like Braille and really unique concepts of how this worked. For example, they would use knotted strings and sticks and pins sewn together. And the most notable one that perhaps several of you here know about is William Moon and Moon type in 1840. And William Moon was an adult who lost his vision later on in life. And he developed Moon type, which is a combination of raised Roman letters and arbitrary dots. And what's really interesting is that there's still a very small segment of the senior population in England who still use Moon type today, because they learned it when they were young. In 1867, someone named William Waite invented New York Point, and he was a superintendent of the New York Institute for the Blind, and he was very influential. And New York Point was two dots high and of varying width. It depended on the letter, and it kind of was based on the most frequent letters required the fewest number of dots. And so it was somewhat complicated, but because he was so influential, it was heavily used in the United States. A few more things I need to say. In terms of embossed printing presses. So basically, in the 1800s, for the most part, schools for the blind were developing books for their own students, and that's all. And it wasn't until the 1850s that the American Printing House was developed in the U.S. as a central publishing house. Now, the thing is that because of the influence of some of these people I mentioned, for a very long time, they were producing books in New York Point and Boston type. So in 1870s, APH got funding, but in order to get that funding, they had to commit to producing at least 50% of their books in New York Point. And then the other 50% for some time was Boston type. So it wasn't until the 1910s that they started producing Braille more regularly, I think about 40% of their work. In terms of writing Braille, the Slate and Stylus that many of us know today is very much, pretty much the same Slate and Stylus that Louis Braille created and that he used from the beginning. Now, what's interesting is that versions of the Slate and Stylus were used to write both Braille and New York Point for quite some time, so you would use the same writing implement. In the 1850s, they started developing different mechanical tactile writing machines. And in the 1890s, there was a man named Frank Hall, who was the superintendent of the Illinois School for the Blind, and he developed what probably became the precursor to the Perkins Braille that we know today. And production costs for this this Braille writer were so low that he was able to sell the device to blind people for at a very low cost, and he was very proud of the fact that he made no profit off it. And in the 1890s, he actually gave public demonstrations on the use of this machine, the Hall Braille writer, and he had students write. It was a competition to see how fast they could write by memory and then by dictation. And the winner wrote 85 words per minute by memory and 31 words by dictation. And from the 1800s, the late 1800s onward, Perkins School for the Blind worked very hard on different versions of a similar Braille writer, and this led to eventually what we know today as the Perkins Brailler, which was developed in 1951. Two more things I need to say. In Canada, the situation was fairly similar. Sighted professionals were using raised Roman letters at the very beginning. But because of Quebec and their ties to France, Braille came to us fairly early on. And it was actually Quebec that started using Braille first because of this connection. And so when the Nazareth Asylum, which became the INLB later on, our French Rehab Center here in Quebec, when they were established in the 1860s, they were already using Braille as their primary method. And what's really interesting at the time, just as a side note, is that these schools in Canada, and particularly in Quebec, were run by nuns, religious professionals. And because they were taught by nuns, they only educated girls and boys up to age 12, and then only girls after age 12, not boys, because they felt it would be it wouldn't be appropriate. So that's really kind of a flip to what happens in society, where girls were educated far less, but the situation is very different at the School for the Blind here. And today, the House of Louis Braille is a place that blind people go to, have gone to for decades, to kind of see where the story began, and kind of like a pilgrimage. And for quite some time, the World Blind Union has been working very hard on establishing Louis Braille's birthplace as a UN-designated World Heritage Site, which would afford it different protections, you know, so that you can't just bulldoze it down and build a McDonald's. Unfortunately, from the research that we've done, it doesn't seem as though that this has happened yet. So the advocacy continues, and it kind of raises the question of, is there something that authorities from around the world could do to support this initiative? Because it's such an important piece of our history. And if you go to La Maison de Louis Braille, you'll find a plaque outside the house. And I have a quote here, what that plaque says. So it reads, "In this house, on January 4th, 1809, was born Louis Braille, inventor of writing in raised dots for use by the blind. He opened the door of knowledge to those who cannot see." This is written in print and Braille, and it was put outside his house in 1952 at the centenary of the adoption of Braille in France. So I think I will stop there so that Jen can tell you about the 20th century and how the story continues.
Thanks, Natalie. Can you all hear me? Oh, Natalie, you can tell me if...
I hear you.
Can you hear me? Okay, I assume that everyone else can hear me. No need to unmute. And again, just a reminder, if you're not muted, please do press *6 because we can, you know, then you can do dishes and make a coffee and whatever it is that you want to do while you listen, and it won't cause any background noise for us. So *6 will mute you, and at the end, if you have questions, *6 will unmute you. So getting back into things, Natalie has already given us a great history of sort of pre-Braille, tactile reading, and on into Braille, and its adoption in 1854 in France. And
Hi, Jen, it's Dwyla. Can you just speak a little louder or move a little closer to the microphone?
Oh, sure. I am, but if it continues to be a problem, I'll switch phones.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Can you hear me better?
Yes, I think we can hear you all right. But if somebody has JAWS in the background, if you can press *6 to mute your line so that we don't have the background noise, that'll probably help as well.
Thank you. Okay, let me know if you can't hear me. Just Natalie or Anthony, who will, should be the only people not muted, maybe one of you guys can just yell at me. So I'm going to pick the story up just before 1900, and Natalie has touched on some of the things that I'll get into and some of the things, because she's gone into more detail, I'll just sort of brush on by them. So we discussed how Quebec was sort of the first province to begin using Braille. One of the things that's important to note about this time period as well is that, of course, at that time there were some schools for the blind in Canada, more than there are remaining today. And they were really the only ones that were producing Braille on any sort of significant scale. So kids were, you know, kids who attended these schools, and Natalie's going to get touch on education more at the end, but basically blind children, if they were sent to school, they were always sent to schools for the blind at this time, or pretty much always, and they were just automatically taught Braille sort of regardless of the amount of vision they had. So these kids were getting Braille instruction, and they had access to some books, of course, not like we have today, but it was very different for adults. So where I'm going to pick up the story, and I just thought this was kind of an interesting little tidbit of information. In 1898, Sir William Mulock basically put forward the pushed forward the franking exemption, which was is the Canada Post free matter for the blind that we know today. And it was basically upon the premise that what books there were could not possibly be shipped here and there and everywhere across our vast dominion if people had to pay what the going rates would have been because of the costs would have been prohibitive due to the weight of the books. So that's kind of where we're starting. One thing that I find quite fascinating about the whole story of Braille, and again, Natalie touched on this, but the fact that the code that has ended up winning out and being the best in terms of tactile, in terms of literacy for us, was invented by a blind person. And I feel like that is very fitting, not to, denigrate or whatever the word is, the sighted people who are involved in producing it and teaching it and who are enthusiastic about it. But I just think it's really, I think that's just a really neat thing about Braille, that it was invented by someone who really needed it. So we've got this Canada Post thing in place, but as I said, there wasn't a lot of reading material to be shipped around. And then in 1906, we have the founding of the Canadian Free Library for the Blind. And this started in Toronto, as I said, in 1906, by Edgar Bertram Friel Robinson. You gotta love the name. And he went by Bert, and he was the first blind person in Canada to graduate to obtain a university degree. And he went on to found this library with his wife, Marion. And this, I mean, it sort of just sounds like, okay, they started a library, that's great. But this was a huge thing in Canada, because not only was it the first of its kind, it was able to promote literacy in a way that just wasn't being done elsewhere. The schools for the blind were producing books, but there was really nothing for adults. There was no, you know, like we have today, we can get books and we can read, you know, kind of for pleasure or for whatever. So this was a huge deal. And you know, apparently Mr. Bert Robinson was a very persuasive man and was able to raise a lot of money, a lot of funds to get the library going, and he felt very passionate about it. And he died after a couple of years. He died in 1908. He wasn't very old. But his wife carried on for several years. She worked until she got to the point. She was a teacher by trade, and he convinced her to quit teaching and help him run the library. And after he died, she continued on until she got to the point where they really couldn't pay her very much, and she needed to go back to teaching. But she always helped out with the library still as a volunteer. And this library was sort of the basis a huge element in the founding of CNIB as well, which we'll come to. Our focus is on Braille, so I talk about CNIB only really in the context of Braille and how it fits into that role. So that's sort of where things stood in the early 20th century, and I just want to read you a couple of things. So one of the things that happened with this library was that it was doing quite well. They would get funding, and they had hired at one point a man to help them with some fundraising. He turned out to be a bit of a scammer, and he wanted more money. He wanted to be paid more and more for doing this fundraising, and finally the library, the CFLB, said, we actually can't pay you that, and so they parted ways. But then this man continued to say that money that went to him was going to buy books for blind people, even though it totally wasn't. So this was a big scam, but people weren't aware that he was no longer with the library. So at one point, a man named Sherman Swift, who took over sort of running the library, particularly after Bert Robinson's wife wasn't able to be full-time anymore. And Sherman Swift was also one of the original founders of CNIB, but we'll come to that. But Sherman Swift wrote a letter to the Honorable Walter Scott, the Premier of Saskatchewan, not as opposed to Sir Walter Scott. And he was writing to him about this scandal that had happened with the swindling fundraiser. And I just want to read you a couple sentences from it just because it's fun and people don't really write like this anymore. So this is a quote somewhere around 1912, 1913 to the Premier of Saskatchewan. What happened was this swindling fundraiser guy said he was raising money for something called the Dominion Tactile Press. And so that was sort of part of how he managed to scam people. So Sherman Swift explains all this, and then he gets to these couple of paragraphs that I'm going to read you because I think they kind of made me giggle a bit. The mere fact that the promoters of this contemptible enterprise had been clever enough to put themselves within the law by actually printing a bundle of trash in raised print does not make the concern any more honest or sincere. And then a little further on, he says, the grant of your government has therefore been employed, if employed at all, in wicked and useless reduplication. Wicked because it uses up money which might be devoted to the production of new work, useless because the stuff is never read, nor could it be read, so horribly printed is it. I say without any hesitation whatever that the Dominion Tactile Press has not 5 bona fide readers of its trash in your province. So tell us how you really feel. Don't hold back. Another quote that I wanted to read just to kind of emphasize the significance of this library and what it meant to people of its day. This is a quote from Kitty Curry of Toronto in 1914, and she actually spent some time volunteering at the library as well. I don't know what I would do if it were not for our library, and library is capitalized. I am of a melancholy disposition, and as I must depend solely on myself for reading, if I am deprived of what literature we have in raised print, I fear to think what would become of me. And one of the things, Natalie talked about the different codes that were in use, and I'm going to talk about the War of the Dots in a couple of minutes, but at this time, the library used primarily New York Point because that's what Edgar Bertram Friel Robinson knew. That was the code he had learned at the School for the Blind, which is now W. Ross McDonald's. So that's what he knew. So that's kind of primarily what they used. But as time went on, and Sherman Swift, there's a lot of documentation on this, and I'll come back to that. But basically, they started relying more on books produced in Britain because they were so well done. They were of better quality than what could be found in North America. And because in Britain, they were using kind of an English version of Braille, which is basically it was Braille as Louis Braille had developed it. So that's why Braille started to gain prominence, because what the British were producing was just of better quality. Another thing to know, as time went on, the library actually circulated more than books. The annual report from 1917 noted that the Canadian Free Library for the Blind was supplying and this is a quote, blind persons in many parts of the Dominion with Braille paper, typewriters, Braille and New York Point slates, and playing cards. So they were, Natalie talked about sort of the development of some early Braille writing devices, and they were able to, you know, on occasion supply those to people across the country. So they really were doing more than just being a library. And so as that's going on, of course, you know, World War I starts in August of 1914, and that is significant in, well, obviously in a lot of ways, but in terms of our story time for today, one of the effects that the war had was on fundraising. It actually became harder for the library to raise funds to continue its work because, of course, people were supporting the war effort, and, you know, I can understand that, but it did have this effect on what the library was able to do, but they did keep going. But the flip side of it, sort of the, again, not that it was a positive thing, but the way that it has affected us down to, even down to today, is that because of all the blinded soldiers, countries, this happened in Europe as well, but in Canada and in the U.S. to a lesser extent, but in Canada in particular, because the ratio of, you know, we were a population of, you know, somewhere around 6 or 7 million and over 600,000 Canadians enlisted. So you're talking about a huge, you know, and of those, there was quite a high percentage of, obviously, fatalities and injuries, wounds, and blindness was a huge factor because of the gas attacks. So what you had finally was a large group of blind people who sort of felt that, you know, we sacrificed for our country. You can't just ignore what we need. And society sort of started to realize this. Another factor in this was that many of these soldiers went to a place called St. Dunstan's in London, which was a place where they could go. It was recovery, but it was rehabilitation and training. And Braille was very much promoted. Braille and independent living skills and all those kinds of things. So people who went there, soldiers who went there, really came back to Canada with this desire to bring back what they had found and what they had received there. So that was kind of the impetus of the founding of CNIB, was that it was these veterans who had learned these skills and said, we need this in Canada, because what was happening for a while was that people were petitioning the government, the Canadian government, to send them to Britain so they could go to St. Dunstan's. And it was like, okay, come on, guys, we need to have something in Canada for our soldiers. So I'm not going to get into details of the founding of CNIB and all that, but it's important because CNIB has played a huge role when it comes to Braille in Canada. So that's sort of why it's important. Another event was the Halifax explosion in 1917 on December 6th, basically to not get caught on a tangent in this story. Two boats, the Mont Blanc and the Emo, collided in Halifax Harbor, and they didn't blow up right away. It was about 20 minutes, and so people were kind of watching, as people do, and a number of people were blinded or lost one eye and still had the use of the other one. But so this really raised awareness of kind of the health side of the medical side of treatment of eye diseases and different things like that. But it also, again, brought blindness more into the public, you know, public awareness. So, CNIB founded in 1918, and it sort of amalgamated the library, which is part of why the library is an important piece of the history as well. So the library still continued to kind of be its own branch under the, you know, within CNIB. It was a part of CNIB, but it was very much continued to maintain books. It also started to, you know, provide books in other formats eventually, but again, we're not really going to go into that today. If you're interested in more details about this and even about a lot of things Natalie and I have talked about, there's a site called thatallmayread, and it's all one word, thatallmayread.ca, and there's a lot of detail there. Anyway, we're, you know, here we are at the end of the First World War, and books are still being embossed in all kinds of different codes, and I've sort of got a list of them here, but Natalie talked about them in a bit more detail. New York Point, Moon, you know, there was American Braille, British Braille, based on Louis Braille's alphabet, which again sort of ended up winning out because it ended up, you know, they were able to get the best quality of books. So with that sort of brings us to the addition of contractions and those sorts of modifications that started to make Braille more what it is today. But throughout the 20s and 30s, this is where we get to the war with the dots. And I find it sort of fun that this is what it's called, because it does make it sound very dramatic. And I suppose it was, in a way. People felt very strongly that whatever code they felt was the best, you can bet that most people, you can be assured that they were quite vocal about whichever code they believed was the best one. And, you know, sighted people had their opinions, blind people had their opinions. You know, it was quite just to give you an idea. And I think I've told this story before, but a couple of years ago at one of the International Council on English Braille General Assemblies, we were talking about UEB, and someone mentioned that she'd been having a discussion with an older lady, someone in her 80s, and we're talking about UEB, and this woman who was, you know, in her 80s, sort of at the beginning of the 21st century, made some comment to Jennifer Dunham, who is the one who tells the story. This woman said, "Oh, I don't know what these young people in their 60s are talking about, because in my day, Braille was changing every week." So I just thought it was kind of funny because, she was sort of right in the sense that there was this tug of war going on, and there was a committee that sort of said, hey, we need to talk about this, we need to standardize this, and there was lots of argument. And this committee at one point pulled in Helen Keller because she was quite well-respected and widely known, well-respected. And so someone had the idea of pulling her in and saying, look, what do you think? Which one should we use? And at this point, I believe, from what I can remember, the debate had been sort of narrowed down, except for sort of the diehards, or kind of the Moon fans, and I shouldn't call them fans, but adherents in the UK. In the United States and Canada, it was sort of down to New York Point and Braille by this time. And Helen Keller was very much an advocate of Braille. She felt that it was more practical, it was more user-friendly, it was easier to read, it was quicker. And so she didn't hesitate to give her opinion, and the committee took her advice. And so that's essentially that kind of, I say kind of, for the most part, brought an end to the war of the dots. I mean, there was still sort of some dissent. I feel like I'm sort of just using that same language. But that kind of settled the question about which code was going to be used. And so people gradually came on board. Contractions were added to help save space. And, again, this was, you know, this was a – there were contractions in the sense of, you know, we had grade one and grade two, and then there was sort of grade one and a half, which was kind of a I actually have one book in grade one and a half Braille, and it sort of uses some of the contractions, but not all of them. So you might have a word like there, T-H-E-R-E, and instead of the dot five, the, it uses the sign and then R-E. So there are different things like that. I don't think it uses the D-I-S contraction, things like that. So this is what's going on in sort of the 1920s and 1930s, and of course, residential schools for blind kids were still quite prominent. Agreement in English Braille finally comes to North America. We've got more Braille devices, Brailler-type devices being invented. The PICT Pichter-Brailer. It's P-I-C-H-T. I'm not quite sure how that's pronounced. There was something that was like a Braille typewriter that had a whole bunch of keys. Braille presses were kind of used. You could make, they make like a huge metal plate and then press it onto the paper, which some places still use varieties of these for certain things. As Natalie mentioned, the Perkins Brailer was invented in 1951. And again, it was sort of like, you know, there were all kinds of devices, and well, not all kinds, I shouldn't say that. There were a few devices, but the Perkins kind of won out for a number of reasons, funding and things like that, but also its usability, its effectiveness, efficiency, things like that. I'm just going to read you one more quote, and this was in 1959. This just kind of gives you an idea of how technology is beginning to, or you know, is just continuing to advance throughout the 20th century. And this is the quote: "An electronic brain as big as a basketball court translated English yesterday into bumpy Braille code for the blind." Okay, never mind that they can say it's from English to Braille, but yeah. So there was a huge computer-like device at the end of the 1950s that was used to transcribe something. This is from the New York Herald Tribune in 1959. In the late 1960s, again, you know, CNIB by this point is quite involved in helping to produce Braille, especially textbooks and things. The library at this point has thousands, 5,000 Braille books, something like that, and the amount was always increasing. Of course, by that time they had audio as well, and you can read up on that, but that's not audio is not Braille, and Braille is not audio, so we are not going into detail on that today. One thing to note throughout all of this is that print has been changing. So from, you know, when Louis Braille invented Braille, over the last 200 years, print has changed significantly. Of course, you know, a B is still a B, that kind of thing, but the way print is laid out, the kinds of symbols, the kinds of things that need to be represented in print has changed quite a bit. So because print was changing, Braille also needed to change so that it could represent what was represented in print, because if this didn't happen, Braille would not be useful. If you couldn't convey in Braille what you could convey in print, blind people were going to be left out, were going to be behind, were going to be at a disadvantage. So as the 20th century is, you know, plodding along, the, you know, print is changing as it's changing. Symbols are being added eventually of things like, you know, the at sign and, you know, other computer-related symbols. And so just as Braille sort of becomes more established and different things are happening, you have in 1972, and here I'm just kind of going to be highlighting some significant things in the Braille world over this time. You have Abraham Nemes basically invents the Nemes code for mathematics. He was a mathematician. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this name. He was a mathematician, and there wasn't really a good code for math at the time, so, or at least not one that he knew about or that was prevalent, so he invented one. And this was 1972, and it became, as you know, it became quite widely used. At this time also, and again, Natalie will talk about this more, but because there was a shift toward integration of blind kids in the public system, it became more and more important for Braille to, you know, to be able to keep up, to be able to be an effective tool. Otherwise, it was a struggle as it was to keep things going, because teachers had to learn it, and there had to be money there to produce it. There were, of course,
Jen,
advances.
Just so you know, it's about 2:00.
Okay, thank you. So there continued to be some advances in technology. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but by the end of the 1970s, there were Braille displays, the first versions of Braille displays. One of the interesting things to note, because we're not really doing a technology presentation today, but one of the things that I think is really neat about the beginnings of Braille displays is that you did not need a screen reader to use a Braille display. You could just plug them in. You had to do a few things, but you didn't need to have a screen reader as well. So with that, I'm just going to get back to Braille codes. The Braille Authority of North America was founded in 1976 because, again, it was sort of recognized that there needed to be some standardization, there needed to be a body in place that had some authority, even though it's not legislative authority, at least it can have some say in how things are, you know, in what happens and give some guidance. So this was the Braille Authority of North America, and to this day there are Canadians, CNIB is a full member of BANA, there are Canadians very much involved in BANA, but it was also recognized that in Canada, that Canada needed to be able to have an independent voice. We are not the United States, and there are things that are different about us, and on the international stage, organizations in Canada felt that we needed to be able to represent ourselves. And so in the early 1990s, the Canadian Braille Authority, which is our origin, that was founded. Founding members are CNIB, CCB, Canadian Council of the Blind, and INLB, l'Institut Nazareth et Libre. So, again, this isn't, I'm not going to talk about the history of BLC, except to say that part of why it was founded was that the International Council on English Braille was founded around the same time, and in order for a country to be a member, that country needs to be represented by a Braille authority. And if Canada did not have one, we would be represented under BANA, and it as we know, it can be a bit hard because the U.S. is so much bigger that we felt that we wouldn't really have as much of a voice if we did that. Now, just very quickly before I finish, because I don't have much more to say, part of the impetus of the International Council on English Braille was a recognition that Braille, well, it started with, ironically enough, a request by Abraham Nemeth and Tim Cranmer, who were both blind. I think that's important to note. They are Braille users. They made the request to update the code and to unify it because they said, this is crazy. There are too many different codes. There are sort of stopgap measures put in place to deal with things that weren't originally included in Braille, and it was becoming like a bit of a Lego tower where you pull a piece out somewhere to put it somewhere else, and the whole thing kind of falls over. So it was getting really complicated to try to put all the pieces together. And that's what BANA was trying to do. They were trying to, like, oh, we need a symbol for such and such. Well, let's use this. Oh, you can't use that symbol because that means, you know, whatever over here. So they said, well, let's make it a separate code so you can't use this symbol over here. You can only use it in computer Braille, or you can only do this, or you can only do that. So Nemeth and Cranmer said, hey, we need to unify the codes. We need to really kind of do an overhaul. And so BANA took this on, but then conversations kind of developed to say, hey, hang on, there's still variations in the English-speaking world, such as just some of the contraction rules that were applied. So it was decided at that same point that not only should we unify the codes, but we should unify them around the English-speaking world. And so it was felt that an international council should be put together so that that council could take on this project. So that's kind of how all that piece came together. And so that happened. The council was formed, CBA was formed so that we would have a voice. All major English-speaking countries around the world are members, not all of them, but and in 2004, ICEB voted that UEB was robust enough that it could be adopted in member countries. There was still some work to be done, but they said, you know what, we've got enough things in place that it can be adopted. And so where we're at now is that all of the member countries of ICEB, so Australia, Canada, Ireland, New Zealand, South Africa, Nigeria, the United Kingdom, and the United States have adopted UEB. It's also Nepal is using it, and they're actually attempting to become a member because they use English quite a bit. It's being used in Japan and in islands in the South Pacific. We're actually doing research to try to find out where else it's being used. It's used in Europe, many European countries for ESL as well. So that's kind of where UEB is at. That is why it's it came into being, and I guess that's sort of where, I mean, the only thing I'll say, of course, is that the U.S. is still using Nemis and having some issues trying to reconcile dealing with having, you know, UEB technical and Nemis, but that's a whole other story for another talk about fascinating Braille tales. So with that, I will hand it back to Natalie.
Excellent. That was very interesting. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to very briefly fill in some of the missing pieces to the story that relate specifically to education and rehabilitation during the 20th and 21st century as it relates to Braille. And I'm not going to talk for very long so that we have some time for questions and discussion, but I think it's still an important part of the story that we both wanted to share with you today. So as Jen mentioned, the focus for the most part in kind of the field of blindness, if you want to call it that, was historically on children, education focused on children. And this meant that the books that were produced were primarily for students and not for adults. And Jen mentioned that we had the Halifax explosion and the two world wars, and that was like immensely influential to the development of rehabilitation and blindness rehabilitation for adults. And in the 1930s, what later became known as the Association for the Education and Rehabilitation of the Blind and Visually Impaired, AER, met to try to start developing professional standards for blindness professionals. And this included those people who as part of their independent living skills, were offering Braille instruction. And at that time in the early 20th century, what's really interesting to know is that rehabilitation instructors primarily consisted of blind volunteers that were known as home teachers, primarily women. And so they would go to your house if you were a blinded adult, and they would teach you Braille, and they would teach you how to sew and other skills that they felt that were needed at that time. And it wasn't until the 1960s that the first master's program to become a blindness professional was established, and that was at Western Michigan University. So they're actually the oldest university program. So I guess I'm gonna skip over some of this, but what I wanted to share with everyone is kind of the evolution of education as it relates to Braille. So if you go back to the 1950s, at that time, most students, all students with visual impairments, regardless of whether they were blind or they had low vision, attended schools for the blind. And they all follow the same curriculum. They were all taught Braille. If you had partial vision, you were typically blindfolded and you were taught Braille. And at that time, it was believed that an over-reliance on your remaining vision would lead to further blindness. So that's why this was done, for one reason. But what happened in the 50s is that there were a whole bunch of medical advancements. And so premature babies were surviving where before they wouldn't have, and this is because the incubator was invented. And this led to many children who were born with retinopathy of prematurity, or ROP, which some of you may know about. And so all of a sudden there were all these blind children who needed to be educated and supported, and the schools for the blind couldn't necessarily meet that growing need on their own. And this is part of what led to mainstreaming students with visual impairments into the regular school system, and the idea of teachers of students with visual impairments visiting the students in those schools to provide specialized instruction in the extended core curriculum and all the blindness skills that they need to know, like Braille. Around that same time in the 50s and 60s, we were starting to gain a better understanding of low vision and how to better support students who have functional vision. And for many reasons, that's a good thing, but it had the unintended effect of leading to, of being one of the reasons why there was a decrease in Braille instruction. And that was never the intention of the pioneers of that time, who were kind of researching and learning more about low vision, but it's part of what happened. And so today, you know, we're kind of dealing with a school system where TVIs are traveling from school to school, and they have very demanding caseloads. And while I would say that, you know, professionals in the fields do believe strongly in the importance of Braille literacy, there are challenges that we need to meet. And it does happen that there are students who can benefit from Braille, but who are not necessarily introduced to it. And that could be for a variety of reasons. It could be due to resources. It could also be due to the fact that there's a lot of inconsistency in terms of how decisions are made. Sometimes it's left to professional judgment rather than, you know, using an established assessment to come to those decisions. And also recognizing that, you know, needs change as you get older, and that you might be able to read print now, but what about when your reading load increases considerably? So that's kind of a whole other conversation, but it gives you a sense of how things began to change. And in the 70s, in fact, as early on as the 60s, we started to see technological advancements. And that included the earliest attempts to develop a refreshable Braille display, which Jen touched on. And you can kind of see over the past 40, 50, almost 60 years now, hard to believe, but how things have evolved so rapidly. Some of you may remember perhaps even using things like the Opticon, which I never used, but I have seen before, and they were very popular for a very long time. And they weren't for Braille users, but they were a tactile form of accessing information nonetheless. And then many of you may also remember the VersaBrailler, which was very popular in the 90s, until what we have today, which are refreshable Braille displays of different lengths and capabilities. And more importantly, what we're starting to see now are low-cost Braille displays, which is kind of the new frontier, in that now that we've established ways to develop the devices to access greater amounts of Braille, electronic Braille, we need to now make that accessible to more people so that they're not restricted based on their income. And the other important change that we've been seeing, particularly over the past decade, is an increase in the number of older adults with acquired vision loss. So all of a sudden, the majority of people that we're seeing in the rehabilitation system are not people who have congenital visual impairments or congenital blindness. These are people who lose their vision later on in life, either due to macular degeneration or diabetic retinopathy or retinitis pigmentosa. These are the primary clients that we're starting to see. And there isn't a lot of historical information on how to best support older Braille clients, because a lot of the curricula developed in the past was designed more for children, and there's not a lot of research on the needs of Braille learners as they age. And so this is kind of a new trend that we're starting to see. How do we support older people who learn Braille? Because what Braille does is it provides you with choice, so that even if these older adults are accessing information through audio, that isn't necessarily the best option for them. And it certainly, I would say, that it shouldn't be the only option simply because we're not providing it as an option, right? We're not providing Braille as an option. So these are some of the new discussions that we're starting to see. And as a conclusion, in conclusion, as I would say, when Jen and I prepared this presentation, we started thinking about, okay, where do we go from here, right? Like, what are some of the trends that we're going to be talking about in future? So as we look to the future, we can see we've made a lot of progress in the past, but also we can start to think about kind of where we go from here in terms of future themes or priorities. And so we came up with five. These are just the ones that came up to our minds. And during the discussion, if you have thoughts about others that we haven't included, and I'm sure there are, you know, feel free to jump in. But the five we came up with, I'll just list them quickly. Number one is Braille technology and the push for lower cost Braille displays. So we talked a lot about that already. Number two is adults and senior learners. Given the growing prevalence, we need to know more about how to provide effective Braille instruction for them, but also we need to develop more resources and programs to support older learners of Braille. And then number three is stigma. So the public education to dispel common misconceptions about Braille, and this is very much tied to blindness because much like in other areas of blindness, we're starting to see more and more laws to protect our rights, but there are many invisible barriers we face in society due to the perceptions people have. And I think those conversations are happening now and need to happen more and more as it relates to Braille in the future. Number four is attention devoted to updating and strengthening legislation within the education and rehabilitation system, and also copyright. So we're seeing the introduction of the new federal legislation, the Federal Accessibility Act. We know about the Marrakesh Treaty that allows the sharing of materials between countries, the UNCRPD. So we need to more and more have conversations about how these laws work in practice as it pertains to access to Braille. And then number five, promotion of the TVI and transcriber professions, because people in these fields may be close to retirement, and so we need to promote the fact that these professions exist and to help support future generations of these professionals so that we're able to meet the needs that exist in the community. And finally, what I would say is I think one of the things I hope we highlighted through all of these discussions is that literacy really is the cornerstone to everything else, right? And so as things begin to change for people who are blind, and as Braille became more prominent, you start to see blind people becoming more involved in education, in society, in employment, and obviously there's still far further we need to travel, but we've also made a lot of progress. And so one of the things that I think is important to highlight is that while there are always all these other options, we shouldn't be viewing them as replacements to Braille, right? And it's really Braille that I think opened a lot of these doors for blind people, and especially when you think back to the history and the significance of its creation by a person who's blind, and that we now still carry the symbol of that in the birthplace of Louis Braille, that Braille isn't just a method used by blind people, it's kind of interwoven in our history. So I think we'll stop there, and we'll take any questions or comments you have, and I hope that you found our talk today interesting.
Well, thank you, Jen and Natalie, for that. To make this easy, what I'll do is if you have a comment you want to make or if you have a question you'd like to ask, just start now by saying your name, and I'll make a list and go around from there so that we don't have everybody talking over each other. We'll give everybody up to 2 minutes and so that we can try to give everybody who wants to speak a chance, and we'll go from there. So
it's
who
Peg.
Would...
Peg?
Okay. Anybody
Kim.
Else?
Kim.
Kim?
Thanks.
Yep.
Who was that?
Peg, Kim, who was the last person?
Peg in Vancouver.
Anyone else other than Peg and Kim?
Okay, well, Peg, you're up first then.
Just a quick question about the initial development of the Nemeth Code. I remember using it in Jericho Hill, and I was there until 1967. And I think, I can't quite remember when we started to use it, because before that they had the, I think it was the Taylor Code or something. But
yeah.
I do remember learning some Nemeth when I was in school. And I know, of course, after that, when I proofread it about 10 or 12 years later, it was quite different from then. But that's why I'm just wondering if Abraham Nemeth may have started to develop it in the 60s.
Yeah, 1972 was that's when the code book was finalized. That's when it really...
Oh, when it was finalized. Okay.
Yeah, so I shouldn't have said he invented it. It's just that's when the year on the original code book. So likely... Yeah, people were probably using it before then, but that's also why you would have found it quite, you know, maybe a bit different when you proofread it later.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it did exist when we went to school.
Thanks for
no problem.
Bringing that up. Clarification.
No problem.
Kim?
I had a couple of tiny questions. One, you didn't mention Music Braille, and I know that Louis Braille started that, but... Is Music Braille universally the same across the world?
Yes.
And also, you mentioned a kind of a slate somewhere along the way, early on when you were reading one of the quotes. I wonder if it would be similar to the slate and stylus. Were the slates always very similar to the slate and stylus we have today?
So yeah, I just made one tiny little comment about Music Braille in that when Louis Braille published his first edition of his code book in 1829, that included music code. And that's the music code, it's the universal music code that hasn't really changed. And in terms of the slate and stylus, the slate and stylus that Louis Braille used back in his time is virtually identical to what we use today, with some small changes. And in particular, what you start to see, especially in the early 1900s, and more as Braille becomes predominant, are different types of slates. So you see the pocket slates and the, you know, business card size slates and the full page slates and the desk slates. So that evolved over time, but what Louis Braille was using was fairly identical to what you would have today, the standard four-line slate.
Could I just ask a follow-up question about the slate then?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, is that okay?
Yep, go ahead.
So I know initially people would have had to learn to write Braille only on the slate before the Perkins came, but then I remember I learned the Perkins first, but I learned the slate almost right after, which I don't know. How did that develop? Like, were there a lot of theories about what to teach someone when and, you know, because the dots are the opposite side and all of that kind of stuff, you know? Was there a lot of talk about that as well?
Well, the slate was used for a really long time until the Perkins kind of gained popularity, and as you remember, Kim, back probably right just before my generation, people were using the slate all the time, and they
and university.
And still today,
through university, I used it.
Yeah, and there are still people today who can write very quickly with the slate, and just like anything else, it's a question of practice, right? If you use it all the time, there's nothing stopping you from using a slate and stylus effectively. But when the Perkins was invented in 1951, it was seen as really revolutionary, and what's really funny when I was reading up on it is that there was a comment that one of the advantages of the Perkins is that it was quiet.
Oh, really?
which tells you how our standards change over time. But no, I haven't seen too much written about, you know, pros and cons of one versus the other. I think it was very much just providing a different way to write Braille that kind of afforded a bit more flexibility.
Sorry, I just meant pros and cons about when to teach.
Oh, yeah, no, I haven't seen
order or anything like that.
Really anything about that. I mean, I think it tends to depend on where you are. I know that when I taught Braille, I would usually introduce the Perkins first, and then once the clients, these were all adults, once they felt comfortable with the Braille alphabet, not even necessarily all of it, I'd start teaching them how to use the slate and stylus. But I would start teaching the Perkins a bit earlier on.
I wish I'd had the slate and stylus taught earlier before the Perkins, because it's like giving someone a typewriter and then giving them a pen. They're going to be like, oh, the typewriter is way faster.
And that's a good point. When I was young and I learned Braille in elementary school, I was taught the slate and stylus actually really early on. Probably around the same time I was introduced to a Perkins, like right from the beginning. And
me too.
I'm glad
that grade
happened.
Two, I think I had the slate. I think I had it.
Yeah, I think, as Natalie said, there was different, it probably depended on where you were. I was introduced to it, but I wasn't, as I got older then, I was more encouraged to use it. By the time I got to high school, I didn't like it, but I chose it because I could hide it in my bag, and I couldn't hide a Brailler in my bag.
Well, and I also know that I had teachers who would not let us write on Perkins at all, because they said when you get out in university or college, you will have to write on the slate, and it is how I did, well, not all of my university, but a lot of it was note-taking on slate, and I didn't have note-takers, like, in class or anything. So I'm glad they made us, you know, do it, like, a lot, because...
Is there anybody else with a question or comment?
Karen?
Karen?
Okay, I'm just overwhelmed with all the information. And since I'm pretty new to that field of Braille in itself, I'm learning it. So I have basically no idea what kind of Braille I'm learning. I only see, or I only can say I'm learning the alphabet, or I started off with shapes and textures and different combinations. So I have no idea. Is it Slate or is it Perkinson's? I really don't know.
So I can answer that question for you, Karen. So all these different types of Braille that particularly Jen mentioned in her talk from the 1900s, you know, there was grade 1 and grade 2 and 1.5 and American Braille and British Braille, none of that today really matters, because ultimately what happened in the 1930s is that North America decided on a Braille code that they were using. And so it was the same Braille code essentially used in places like Britain, but with some differences. Like in England, you know, they didn't use the capital sign at the beginning of a sentence because they felt that it would take up more space than was needed. Whereas here, we always use the capital sign. So there were variations, but Braille is Braille. And it's just the same 26 letters that Louis Braille invented in the 1800s. And the only part is that there's what's called uncontracted or grade 1 Braille or contracted and grade 2 Braille. So uncontracted is the alphabet that you're learning, the different letters of the alphabet and the numbers. And then contracted Braille is a more advanced form of Braille where you learn symbols that represent either entire words, like for example, C alone, the letter C alone would be the word can, C-A-N, or symbols that represent frequently occurring letters in a word. So they're short forms, exactly. And the reason there's contracted Braille is so that Braille takes up less space. And if you're following, kind of like if you're learning Braille as a child, you do eventually, you learn contractions, because as your reading loads increase, most novels and like longer texts are written in contracted Braille. For adults in the rehab system, it really depends on your needs, but there isn't anything harder about contractions. It's just that you need to be introduced to those symbols that represent words and things like that. And there are 180 of those short form words in English Braille. I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Jen. Or...
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, too, in terms of some of the terms you mentioned, Karen, like Perkins, and those are just the names of devices that were used to produce it. So it's not a different kind of Braille. It's just there's, you know, different kinds of devices that can produce Braille, and they just have different names.
And if you're using Braille. A Braille machine, it's a Perkins Brailler.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I said, I'm just starting and I'm getting sort of used to terminology and...
No problem. And we'll also have this. This is recorded, so if it helps you or anyone else, we're happy to share the recording afterwards.
Is there anyone else with a question or a comment? We've probably got time for one or two more.
Can you hear me?
Oh.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, Wendy Kala talking. Thanks a lot for Jen and Natalie for the research. And your conference, I think you have a great idea. The story I know, but sometimes it's not a bad idea just to remember or just to... First of all, I have a few comments. The first school for the blind was founded in 1861 in Canada.
Yeah.
Started in Montreal and by Rousselot. He was coming from France. And I think the first children started in 1865, if I remember. They have the first student started with the nun and learning Braille in that time. I'm sure it wasn't that school we know these days, but and after that we had the school in Halifax and Brantford and in Ontario, and that's continued that school for the blind in Canada. My second comment about the Octagon, I was one of the users of this device, and I can tell I like it. There's few things you don't see with scanner these days that the Octagon you can read. And I even did some Braille transcription with that. Well, a bit challenging, but possible. Or sometimes you need it to, just to complete something the scanner doesn't take or doesn't catch or mistake, and that's a great thing to learn print if you don't know no print letters, but if you print before, it's better. And I can see sometimes I miss that device because we can read exactly what you see in print and fast, and that's a bit of patience. But after you're very happy to get one. But now they don't use this device anymore. I know there's a list. I'm on the list, but there's some discussion, but I think they don't know how to do that, to do it. Who's going to do it? Finance that in the States, and that's the discussion with how we see. But people learned it and still have one, and they like to read with it, and there's information they'll have in print without a device.
So thank you, Minik. I'm going to stop you there, just in the interest of time, but thanks for your comments. Yes, the first school was Nazareth Asylum, which eventually became INLB. And it was in the 1860s, and they were the first to use Braille because of their connection.
It was 61. They had a centennial in 1961.
Yes. And then your other comment about the Opticon, it was a very popular device. It was used for a very long time, and there's still people who miss it today. So
I used it as well when I was little.
Yeah, I used it too. And we even took it to restaurants and stuff and let it read menus and stuff. It was at the time it was pretty revolutionary.
Mm-hmm, exactly. It was.
Natalie. Mm-hmm. Back to Anthony, I guess. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, thank
Natalie,
you.
But I guess for moderator.
Well, thank you very much. We're coming up to the end of our allotted time here, so I'd just like to thank Jen and Natalie again for providing all of this great information about the history and the background that we often don't really hear very much about. Of course, you're welcome to contact us if you have any other questions coming out of this discussion, or if you'd like any more information about anything that was brought up today, you can write to the info address, info@blc-lbc.ca. And these recordings will ultimately be made available once they've been cleaned up. And so if you'd like a copy of that, do let us know, and we'll make that available to you. Jen or Natalie, do you have any last words?
I have a quick final note, and that's just to remind everyone, we sent out this information to all members, but we are having our AGM on Saturday, May 4th in Toronto, and stay tuned. We're working on providing an option for those of you who can't attend in person to listen in, but if you have any other questions about the AGM itself, let us know. We'll be sending more information soon, and our next teleconference will take place sometime in June, so stay tuned for that announcement, and we're always happy to receive your ideas for future topics. Jen, did you have anything?
I think our esteemed president has summed things up nicely, and just
excellent.
Thank you to all of you for attending.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks very much.
Have a nice week.